Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dorothy Gundy, Brian Lynn, and Alice Bryant. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a United States federal judge has barred the Trump administration from changing asylum laws. The judge stopped a presidential order that would have blocked immigrants from seeking asylum if they entered the United States illegally. President Donald Trump signed the order on November 9th. It denied asylum to anyone who crossed the southern border without going through official ports of entry. He acted in answer to large groups of Central Americans currently walking to the U.S. border with Mexico. They have said they plan to enter the U.S. Many are fleeing violence in their homelands. Trump described the so-called caravan of Central Americans as a national security threat. U.S. troops are deployed to the border to help stop what Trump has also called an invasion. But on Monday, the judge in the case said that the president is not permitted to rewrite the immigration laws to impose a condition that Congress has expressly forbidden. The U.S. Immigration and Nationality Act says a migrant is permitted to make a claim for asylum up to 1 year after arriving in the U.S. The law does not set any conditions about how they arrive. A lawyer for the Center for Constitutional Rights said the law couldn't be clearer. The center is part of the group that took legal action against the order. The Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, and the Department of Justice answered the court decision in a joint statement Tuesday. It said, "As the Supreme Court affirmed this summer, Congress has given the president broad authority to limit or even stop the entry of aliens into this country." Last June, the Supreme Court ruled that Trump has the power to establish a travel ban against people from some Muslim-majority countries. The federal judge's ruling against the asylum ban, however, will remain in effect for 1 month, barring an appeal. It will also make it harder for the government to deport illegal migrants. DHS officials say about 70,000 people a year request asylum after entering the country illegally. But illegal crossings overall are well below historical highs from previous decades. Trump administration officials had argued that the order is meant to force asylum seekers to go through official border crossings. The legal ports of entry have very long lines of people waiting for entry.
Neanderthals are extinct, but they were the closest relative of modern humans. Up until about 30,000 years ago, human beings shared the earth with Neanderthals. The two species were so close that they sometimes mated. Scientists have long believed that life for Neanderthals was more dangerous and stressful than it was for humans during this period. Some studies have suggested that Neanderthals suffered high injury rates. Scientists have blamed the high rates on social violence, their hunting methods, attacks by meat-eating animals, and the dangers of travel in snow and ice. Katerina Harvati is with the University of Tübingen in Germany. She studies the evolution of Neanderthals and modern humans. Harvati believes the Neanderthals probably did face more dangers than humans do today. But she and other researchers wanted to know if that was true when the two species shared the planet tens of thousands of years ago. To do that, she and her research team studied evidence of head injuries in fossilized Neanderthal remains. They examined information from earlier studies of fossils from Western Eurasia. The skull bones were from about 80,000 to 20,000 years old. The team looked at information in 295 skull fossils from 114 individual Neanderthals. They also examined 541 fossils from the heads of 90 members of our own species, Homo sapiens. The researchers found the injury rates were about the same in the two groups. The findings were published in the journal Nature. It also published a commentary on the study by Marta Mirazone-Lahr of Cambridge University in England. She noted that the findings dispute the idea that the behavior of Neanderthals led to increased danger and risk in their lives. She also said that the study is not the final word because it only examined injuries to the head. Scientists still have to identify the causes of all injuries and how the injured were cared for. That could give us more understanding into the behavior of both Neanderthals and ancient humans, she wrote. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos has proposed new guidelines on a law that protects against sexual violence in schools. The plan, announced last week, would change earlier guidelines created during the administration of Barack Obama. The rules are meant to guide schools in carrying out a 1972 federal law called Title IX. Title IX bars discrimination based on sex at American colleges and universities, as well as at elementary and secondary schools. Schools that receive federal money are required to offer a clear way for students and employees to report sexual assault. Title IX rules require that schools hold fair, open investigations. In addition, they must provide special medical services for victims. Under the new rules, colleges would only be required to investigate accusations if reported incidents happened on school grounds or in other areas overseen by the school. Current rules require colleges to investigate all student complaints, no matter where they happened or how they were reported. The new guidelines also include several changes sought by groups that support students accused of sexual wrongdoing. For example, one of the new guidelines would give accused students the chance to cross-examine their accusers. The new rules also give both accusers and those accused equal rights to see evidence and launch appeals.
The Department of Education says the proposed changes are aimed at providing a fair process to both the accuser and the accused. In a statement, Secretary DeVos said, "We can and must condemn sexual violence and punish those who perpetrate it while ensuring a fair grievance process." Since 2011, schools have used a series of letters issued by the Obama administration as guidance for how to deal with sexual violence complaints. Schools that did not follow the guidelines could be subject to federal investigations and risk losing federal funding. Victims' rights groups had praised the Obama guidelines for helping to prevent schools from not taking sexual violence accusations and investigations seriously. Other groups argued the rules favored accusers too much. Some colleges criticized the guidelines for being complex and taking too long to carry out. DeVos withdrew the 2011 Obama guidelines in September 2017. The newly released 150-page proposal aims to replace them. The new plan must go through a 60-day public comment process before it can be finalized.
Legal experts say the new rules could greatly reduce the number of complaints that schools investigate. Sonny Schuster is a lawyer who has advised several colleges on sexual misconduct cases. She told the Associated Press the majority of incidents of sexual violence happen off school grounds. In such cases, schools would no longer be required to launch an investigation. However, schools could still decide to do so. Other experts say the new plan is likely to reduce the level of education department actions against schools found to be violating Title IX. That is because the new guidelines include a stronger definition for sexual harassment that could make it more difficult to hold schools legally responsible for violations. Several groups and lawmakers have criticized the proposed new guidelines.
The American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, said it strongly opposes the proposed guidelines. In a tweet, the group said the rules would lead to an unfair process favoring the accused. It added that the guidelines would permit schools to ignore their responsibility under Title IX and make schools less safe for survivors of sexual abuse. The head of the National Education Association, Lily Eskelson Garcia, wrote in a statement that by approving the plan, DeVos had failed to carry out the duty to protect all students. Garcia added that the proposed rule changes would encourage schools to ignore students who ask for help.
Virginia Representative Bobby Scott, the top Democrat on the U.S. House Education and the Workforce Committee, urged DeVos to withdraw the proposal. He called the guidelines a damaging setback in efforts to fight sexual violence. Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, a Democrat from Connecticut, is expected to become the next chairwoman of the committee that proposes the budget for the Department of Education. She said in a statement that DeVos's proposal fails to support survivors of sexual violence. If she does not get this right in the final rule, Congress needs to step up to return the proper balance, DeLauro said. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
Now we bring you our American History program, The Making of a Nation. Today we look at the start of the American Revolution. Here is Steve Ember.
The road to revolution in the late 1700s took several years. There were protests against the British policy of taxing the colonies without giving them representation in Parliament. To prevent trouble, the British sent thousands of soldiers to Boston, the largest city in Massachusetts. Jane Gordon, the Director of Education and Public Programs at the Massachusetts Historical Society, explains the mood at the time.
We're looking at a time of great tension. We're looking at a time when there's an expectation, I think, on both sides that something will happen, but nobody knows exactly what or when.
On March 5th, 1770, that tension led to violence. It was the end of winter, but the weather was still very cold. A small group of colonists began throwing rocks and pieces of ice at soldiers guarding a public building. They were joined by others, and the soldiers became frightened. They fired their guns. Five colonists were killed. The shooting became known as the Boston Massacre. The people of Massachusetts were extremely angry. The soldiers were tried in court for murder. Most of them were found innocent. The others received minor punishments. Fearing more violence, the British Parliament removed most of the taxes on the colonists. Only the tax on tea remained. The tensions eased for a while. Imports of British goods increased. The colonists seemed satisfied with the situation until a few years later. Then the Massachusetts colony once again became involved in a dispute with Great Britain. The trouble started because the government wanted to help the British East India Company. That company organized all the trade between India and other countries in the British Empire. By 1773, the company had become weak. The British government decided to let the company sell tea directly to the American colonies. The colonies would still have to pay a tea tax. The Americans did not like this new plan. They felt they were being forced to buy their tea from only one company. Officials in the colonies of Pennsylvania and New York sent ships from the East India Company back to Britain. In Massachusetts, the British governor wanted to collect the tea tax and enforce the law. When the ships arrived in Boston, some colonists tried to block their way. The ships remained just outside the harbor without unloading their goods. On the night of December 16, 1773, a group of colonists went out in a small boat. They got on a British ship and threw all the tea into the water. Destroying the tea was a serious crime. The colonists were dressed as American Indians, so the British would not recognize them. But the people of Boston knew who they were. A crowd gathered to cheer them. That incident, the night when British tea was thrown into Boston Harbor, became known as the Boston Tea Party.
And all of a sudden, with the Tea Party, they say, enough is enough.
Gordon Wood, a history professor at Brown University in Rhode Island, says the Tea Party made Britain furious with the colonies. Parliament reacted by passing a series of laws that punished the whole Massachusetts colony for the actions of a few men. One of these laws closed the port of Boston until the tea was paid for. Other laws strengthened the power of the British governor and weakened the power of local officials throughout the colonies. The laws were called the Coercive Acts. Historian Gordon Wood says they helped unite all the colonies against Britain, even though not everybody approved of the Boston Tea Party.
The Virginians are appalled at the Tea Party. They just think that's just terrible, destruction of all that property. But when they see what the British do, the Coercive Acts, they say to themselves, if they can do that to Massachusetts, the British can do that to us. And they're on board. And that really is the turning.
In June of 1774, Massachusetts called for a meeting of delegates from all the other colonies to consider joint action against Britain. This meeting was called the First Continental Congress. It was held in the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in September of 1774. All the colonies except one were represented. The southern colony of Georgia did not send a delegate. The delegates agreed that the British Parliament had no right to control trade with the American colonies or to make any laws that affected them. They said the people of the colonies must have the right to take part in any legislative group that made laws for them. The First Continental Congress approved a series of documents that condemned all British actions in the colonies after 1763. The delegates approved a proposal by Massachusetts saying that the people could use weapons to defend their rights. They also organized a Continental Association to boycott British goods and to stop all exports to any British colony or to Britain itself. Local committees were created to enforce the boycott. One of the delegates to the First Continental Congress was John Adams of Massachusetts. Years later, he would say that by the time the meeting took place, the American Revolution had already begun. King George II announced that the New England colonies were in rebellion. Parliament made the decision to use troops against the colonists in Massachusetts in January of 1775. The people of Massachusetts formed a provincial assembly and began training men to fight. Soon, armed groups were doing military exercises in towns all around Massachusetts and in other colonies. British officers received their orders in April 1775. By that time, the colonists had been gathering weapons in the town of Concord, about 30 kilometers west of Boston.
It's a gentle landscape. There are no great mountains. There are no great valleys or waterfalls. It's a gently rolling hillside farm landscape. There are two rivers that come together to form another river.
Jane Gordon from the Massachusetts Historical Society lives in the area. She describes what the scene must have been like.
The houses are mostly made of wood. Many of them are not painted. In April, the leaves would just be budding out. Things would be greening up. And actually, the first day of the Revolution was a very warm spring day.
The British forces were ordered to seize the colonists' weapons. But the colonists were prepared. They knew that the British were coming. Years later, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote a poem about what happened. The poem is about Paul Revere, one of three men who helped warn the colonial troops that the British were coming.
Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere on the 18th of April in 75. Hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. He said to his friend, "If the British march by land or sea from the town tonight, hang a lantern aloft in the belfry arch of the North Church Tower as a signal light. One, if by land, and two, if by sea. And I on the opposite shore will be ready to ride and spread the alarm through every Middlesex village and farm for the country folk to be up and to arm."
When the British reached the town of Lexington, they found it protected by about 70 colonial troops. These citizen soldiers were called Minutemen. They had been trained to fight with only a minute's warning. Eight colonists were killed. Each side accused the other of firing the first shot in that first battle of the American Revolution. It became known as the shot heard round the world. From Lexington, the British marched to Concord, where they destroyed whatever supplies the colonists had not been able to save. Other colonial troops rushed to the area. A battle at Concord's North Bridge forced the British to march back to Boston. It was the first day of America's War for Independence. When it was over, almost 300 British troops had been killed. Fewer than 100 Americans had died. The British troops had marched in time with their drummers and pipers playing Yankee Doodle. A Yankee Doodle was a man who did not know how to fight. The song was meant to insult the Americans, but in the end, they were very proud of it.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.